Welcome to the HMO Property Podcast, where we connect, educate, and inspire the UK's HMO property community. So stop what you're doing, sit back, relax, and enjoy the story. Up HMO Nation, and welcome to another episode of the HMO Property Podcast. In this episode, we interview successful HMO property investor, Andy Graham. Andy is going to take us on his HMO property journey, including the ups, the downs, the highs, and the lows. Now, Andy's been investing in HMOs for some 10 years now. He's completed over 100 projects, currently houses 400 plus tenants, in three different locations. So let's jump straight in. So welcome, Andy.
Yes, to me. Thank you, Rupert. Great to be here with you.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks for that. Good. Andy, before we dive into the details of your HMO journey, tell us about you. Give us your background before you started in HMOs.
Before I started in HMOs, okay. I was early 20s when I got started. So the years immediately preceding my first project were at university. Spent a lot of time playing sport, getting drunk, hanging out with friends, doing the usual stuff that, you know, guys do at university. And I immediately qualified. I was a physio. That was my professional career. And I did work as a physio. So I went straight from university into a physio career, but almost as soon as I started in physio, for various reasons, I got my first HMO.
Fantastic. Okay, so going back 10 years, how much time did you do as a physio before you really saw the light and were like, you know, this isn't for me?
Well, it wasn't a light switch moment, to be honest, Rupert. It was something that I gradually became aware of as a kind of potential future career for me. The first one went really well, and I just continued to be a physio and enjoyed having that additional income. And yeah, I enjoyed my lifestyle. I was in Cornwall and I would surf a lot. I worked pretty good hours, you know, an 8-to-4 job. I had a lot of time, but I was still young and I wasn't aware of my entrepreneurial mindset at that point. And, you know, it was over the following few years that it started to become something that I recognise as a potential kind of long-term plan for me.
Got it. So you really cut your teeth on the first one whilst you were still in a job, which is always a good thing to do.
It was. And I was in Cornwall at the time. I lived in the southwest. I went straight from university.
Whereabouts in Cornwall were you?
I lived in a place called Porth Town, which is, a lot of people will know where St. Agnes is. It's very close to St. Agnes. Yep. Lots of great surf. But I went straight from Sheffield, which is where I studied, to Porth Town, to Cornwall. And the HMO that I bought was in the Midlands, which was about 350 miles away.
Wow. Okay. How did that go?
Painfully, in all honesty, and it cost me a lot in fuel, but it was something I enjoyed doing, so it didn't feel like hard work at the time. It was logistically, you know, tricky, but actually, you know, I had the foresight to recognize that if I got it right and it went well, it was definitely going to be worth those kind of weekend trips up and the fuel costs and the time away from home and things.
Got it. And how did you settle on the Midlands? How did that come about?
My sister's a little bit younger than me, and she's a vet, and she was studying to be a veterinary surgeon. And she was living in a student house or near her campus, and I would go and see her with my family periodically just to say hi. And, you know, at this point, I'd already, the kind of the seed of getting a student property had already been sown in me. I just wasn't sure where it was going to be. And actually, after going to see my sister at university, that for a number of reasons, that location started to look like a pretty good prospect.
Got it. So in terms of how you actually got into the world of H, you know, what was, I know you're saying it's not a light bulb moment, but what made you take that first step to buying your first HMO?
I have always been interested in property. My uncle was a builder and I would do bits of labouring work for him. And look, you know, my parents' generation, they did well out of property, like most people who owned any property did, you know, through the 90s. So, you know, I saw that, you know, by doing very little in property, you know, naively, that, you know, it could be, you know, a very good long-term investment. My parents, you know, are definitely not investors either. You know, they've got professional jobs. They just happened to do reasonably well off the back of a, you know, rising market. So my naivety was actually with regards to capital appreciation and things like that. And if we rewind 10 years, you know, that puts us about 2009, so 2008, 2009, well, we know what happened then. At that point, I didn't have a clue what a recession meant, what the implications of that were, what that could or couldn't mean for somebody like me trying to get into property investment. But I just liked the idea of owning a property. And, you know, it really was as naive as that at the time, Rupert.
Fab. I mean, I think those years you're referring to about your parents are what are known as the golden years.
Yes.
Which our generation and certainly the generation behind us will unlikely ever see. Again, certainly not in the same format. So, yeah, don't wait to buy property. Buy property and wait. I think that's the phrase.
Yeah, and you know what? So, I've done that, you know, since I started, Rupert. You know, I've sold two properties, and actually, on both occasions, I've regretted doing it in the end. I wish I hadn't. It made sense at the time. It made a lot of sense at the time. But yeah, you're right. Buy and just hold it, and that is what I do now.
Okay. And was there anything holding you back at the time investing in HMOs?
Yeah, a huge amount. You know, the first big one was access to capital. Yeah, I was 21, I think. So, and I had an idea of buying a student property. I wasn't long since a student. So really, you know, what did I know about being a student landlord? What did I know about buying property? Fortunately, my parents, you know, believed in me, or maybe they just wanted to shut me up enough to lend me a little bit of cash, and they did. And I think I borrowed about 30,000 to get the first one. And I did save very, very hard in Cornwall when I went down. You know, I did kind of, you know, put it up on the board and said, I'm gonna try and buy a property there, and I'm gonna need to save this much up. And mum and dad have said they're gonna lend me this much, and that's what I did. But yeah, the first barrier to entry was definitely capital. The second one was absolutely knowledge. I mean, I really didn't have any idea what was involved in buying a property. I didn't understand anything conveyancing, how to negotiate, what the implications of getting lending were, whether or not there were any legal requirements, you know, from a landlord's point of view. I didn't know enough to even think and check the local market and look at rental confidence and that. So they were definitely limitations that I recognised. But again, I was quite naive and just thought, well, I'll just figure it out.
Yeah, I mean, that's the entrepreneurial spirit, isn't it? It's a bit of naivety and a bucket load of get up and go and can do at all costs. So I'm sure a lot of our listeners will be able to relate to you on that.
Yeah.
Andy, next up, I'm just going to rewind a little bit, and I want you to tell us in as much detail as you can, numerically, about your first property deal. If you don't mind, what did you buy it for? What did you refinance it? What did you rent it out for? And what was it worth at the end?
Okay, absolutely. This property then, it was 2009 when I saw it. I think it completed just in the early sort of state part of 2010. And honestly, this is how it happened. So I'd said, you know, Mom, I'm going to go and buy a student property and there's nothing you can do to stop me. And she thought, you know, she honestly thought I was mad. And if you met her, you know, you could probably see that I got a lot of grief for this. But you know, against her will, I continued on with the idea. And I think, as maybe a motherly instinct, she insisted on at least coming to look at whatever I was going to look at. So I arranged a viewing to go and see something in this area where my sister was studying. And I went to see a property. The agent took me there and I walked in and I knew it wasn't going to work. I could see that the space wasn't going to be divisible to get sort of four rooms in, which is what I had envisioned, you know, a student house. I need to get four rooms. I think I'd probably come out of university living in a four bed house. I thought I'll get a four bed student house. This wasn't going to work. It needed the full refurb and I wasn't really fazed by that, although I hadn't thought it out well. But it wasn't going to work. And I think the agent could see that disappointment on my face. And she said, well, you know what? We've just had an instruction on a property about 100 yards up the road. She said, we've not put it on the market yet. We've not even agreed sort of a price to go on the market with it yet. But do you want me to see if I can get you in and have a look? And I was like, yeah, definitely. And they got me in. We walked up the road. We had a look. And it was a property being sold by the daughter of a lady who was going into care. And this lady had lived in this house since it was built. So give you an idea as to perhaps the condition that the house was in. Structurally, you know, the fabric of the property is absolutely fine, but certainly it needed all the modernization. But it was very clear that you could piece it off, room here, room here, room here, room there. So immediately the four bedrooms were there with the communal space and I got it and I thought, brilliant, this is the one. So I sort of turned and conferred with my mum at the time, you know, who was my only pillar of support. And by this point, she's kind of buying into the idea. But really, she just likes a haggle and she likes a deal. you know, it's like we were at the China Bazaar. And I offered there and then. They sort of said that they were looking for 115. And I thought, well, everyone asks for a little bit beyond their expectations. So I offered 110 there in the kitchen. And they accepted it. The daughter accepted it. And that was it. It was as simple as that. This is definitely something I wouldn't do now.
Remind me which part of the country this is, Andy?
Midlands. So, Midlands. Yeah, northwest Leicestershire. Yeah.
Got it.
So this is a fair property price. It actually went through just under 110,000 because after the survey, there was something with the drains and I went back and just renegotiated another 500 and it all just sailed through. I put a 25% deposit down, whatever that was, you know, the cash mum and dad lent me, and then everything else was savings. I got a deposit. It was with the Mortgage Works.
Classic.
You know, Rupert, I can't even remember whether there was an HMO product then. I'm not even sure, though. I honestly can't remember. What I do remember that's distinctly different to how things are with lenders now, though, is there was the barrier to entry was actually, you know, not really that resistant. It financially, you know, had to tick a few boxes, but didn't need landlord experience to be a HMO owner. You know, they weren't assessing, you know, much beyond the viability of that single property. So it all went through and I put the job out to do the refurb, which was crucial, on my hammer, because of course I didn't know anybody who could do this work. So property completed, I then put the works out to tender and I got some people around to come and quote, and that was a minefield because I just didn't have any idea what things costed, and I didn't understand the concepts of first fix, second fix, upgrading electrics, what that means if you need to chase the walls, dropping ceilings to run cables. So I toyed with a few quotes and really I went with a group of guys that I liked, and they weren't necessarily the best price, but I felt most comfortable.
Okay.
And you know what? I think there was a bit of good luck, and actually they were good guys and they did a reasonably good job with it. And I learned a huge amount, you know, during the process. You know, I learned a lot doing that. The property, the refurb itself, I think I spent about 27,000 or something like that. It was pretty tight. It really, really stretched me. And I actually turned it into a five bed. I got a fifth room out of the back. It took several months. It was over the winter. I remember there was snow, no power, no electrics. And I would go and spend and I would try and help. But eventually got it done. And it wasn't to the standard that you might have seen some of my stuff now. This was really, I got it to a good standard, like a standard that I thought was good, but not a patch on the sort of stuff we do now. And I didn't get it refinanced initially. I just let it run, and I just left that equity in there. And I think I got at least a 3-year fix on it at the time. There was a bit of a bridge between the sort of January when I think it completed and the September when the first students moved in. But I worked with a local agent who had a few student properties there, and they helped me and got some tenants. And actually, that was really easy at the time, and I was quite fortunate. But it was a new market. I got into that market very, very early. So to cut a long story short, they got me 5 tenants. They paid £350 a month. So I think that's 1750 a month. Yeah, I'm gonna work it out quickly.
Yeah, do it.
1750 a month, and that's what they paid. X bills, and they moved in on the 1st of September. And, you know, against all the odds, I'd actually managed to make it work. My mortgage was about £429, I remember rightly. So, you know, the difference was well over £1,000.
What a golden ticket. What did your mum say about that?
Well, let's just say that they kind of clued on very quickly. And it wasn't that easy to borrow money from them again because they went and bought a few themselves. We ended up then going on to buy a small portfolio there, you know, over the next sort of 18 months, 2 years, because that went really well. And actually, Rupert, that property at the time, it was probably clearing, yeah, about sort of £1,200 a month. That wasn't a million miles away from my salary to junior physio. If you put it into context like that, you know, I could see that actually that was a pretty smart thing to do. So that was it. I'd never thought about it like that. I'd never, ever thought about the financial aspect or this could be a business opportunity. And I didn't realize I had this entrepreneurial maybe kind of side to me. But when I saw that actually land in the bank alongside my salary, that was the first real kind of light bulb moment that said, oh, I should do, oh, yeah, maybe I should do another one of these. It was, you know, the next one until I really thought, actually, this could be, you know, significant.
Fab. Great starting story, that. Heard a lot of horror stories in the HMO community about people doing their first one, but sounds like you did pretty well. So excellent. Next question for you, Andy. And it's a big one. How has HMO investing changed your life? You've answered it already a little bit, but how has it actually changed your life?
You know, it has given me a huge amount of freedom, Rupert, because off the back of HMO investment, I've built with my partners a substantial business from it. And that business, although I work incredibly hard, it gives me a huge amount of freedom. You know, I am one of the directors. You know, we can go on holiday. You know, we don't have to ask to go on holiday. We can nip out of the office. We can do that. We're in charge of all our own decisions. And, you know, and from a financial point of view as well, you know, it looks significantly different to, you know, what my professional career as a physio would have been. So yeah, I think just freedom. And for me, you know, financial freedom, you know, means one thing to someone and something else to another one. But actually, to me, that freedom just, you know, is just a feeling of being content, because actually, you know, being able to do what I want under kind of, you know, and have it within my control is actually what I wanted and what I really enjoy.
Excellent. And what's your favorite part of HMO property investing? What's the part you love the most?
It's definitely now piecing together deals. You know, I love identifying the deals, and I love working out how to manipulate that asset to turn it into an investment vehicle. There are lots of sort of variables to consider doing that, and there, you know, lots of moving targets with it, and it isn't something that just happens, you know, at a single point. But I love that piecing together of the deal, from kind of identifying it to pulling the finance in, whether or not you've got investors, and putting all the components together to giving you this beautiful finished product that actually chucks out some money.
Andy, do you love an Excel spreadsheet? Tell me the truth.
No, but my business partner does. My business partner, Nick, and this is the truth, he can draw floor plans on an Excel spreadsheet. Nick does love spreadsheets, and he's like, yeah, wow. He can do anything with them. I just like what the spreadsheets say.
Good. Good, good. Excellent. Okay, so we've talked about your past, but before we move on to the present and your future plans in HMO property, let's take a minute to thank our sponsors.
Are you looking for an effortless HMO mortgage experience? If that's a yes, there's only one place to go. www.thehmomortgagebroker.co.uk, the UK's number one specialist HMO mortgage broker. They're so specialised that they don't do anything else. HMO mortgages, HMO remortgages, and HMO bridging. That's it. They have access to every HMO lender out there, and even some exclusive products not available to other brokers. With lightning fast service and A1 communication, they're easily the best HMO broker in town. So to experience HMO lending made easy, go to www.thehmomortgagebroker.co.uk today.
So, Andy, fast forwarding to the present day, tell us about your current portfolio.
Okay, so it's certainly become a lot more complicated and complex than it was sort of 10 years ago when I was just buying a few HMOs and my parents got involved. Smart Property Now is a business that I have built with my business partner, Nick. And, since sort of 2015 when we incorporated that, a huge amount of my success or our success is due to Nick and James and Jim, our other partners at Smart Property. Smart Property collectively now, we have about somewhere around 400 rooms under the management arm of the business. So, a good portion of those are owned by the directors, with or without some of our investor clients. A good portion of those are on rent-to-rent contracts, as you and I know them, and Smart Property owns those contracts. And we've got a growing arm of the business that offers services to private landlords, just on a more of a management basis. But that's a very strategic decision, and it's because we've identified that if we can build these relationships with the portfolio landlords, that then over the time, over the next sort of 4, 5, 6, 7 years, we will get the opportunity to work with them to buy their properties, maybe to take them on under leased contracts and things like that. So we have a very long-term view about the HMO market and certainly our HMO business.
Quite the operation, 400 units. There must be some serious management infrastructure in the background, which I can probably see a few of their chairs right now.
Yeah. We've got a fair few number of staff now, lots of software that's got to run all this stuff. Nick's an accountant. We've got Roxana, who's a management accountant as well. She's fantastic. Our team are just brilliant. And without those guys, this would not be possible at all. There are lots of moving parts to managing that many rooms. But if you're growing a portfolio to these sorts of numbers, you need that infrastructure to be able to manage this sort of stuff. And certainly if you're working with private investment, you've got a duty to be able to manage that investment long term. And in property, that means managing tenants and actually managing what goes on in the property and the maintenance issues that go along with it.
Andy, next up, tell us your best single HMO investment today.
This one's easy. Look, I can't take full credit for it. It's too big for one man. But it's something that I did with the partners at Smart Property. We took on a block in Fallowfield, which, if you don't know, is the epicentre of Manchester and student homes in Manchester. We took on a block under a guaranteed basis. So I've got a long-term lease, 10-year lease. It's 25 student rooms. It needed a £70,000 refurb. We did the refurb in 4 weeks. We negotiated the contract for 11 months and it got signed kind of on the last day of the 11th month. And we needed tenants for, the following month, which was sort of the July cycle. After all these negotiations and Lloyds Bank were involved, we got it signed. We then managed to pull a team on to refurb a block of 25 student rooms, which was a huge amount of work. And about
you did a 70 grand refurb in 4 weeks.
Yeah, we did. We really did. And it was one of the toughest things we as a team have really had to deal with. But, you know, if I give you kind of an idea of what that looks like now, we rent those rooms. I think they're for sort of close to £500 a month mark, so around £120-ish a week, bills inclusive. The guarantee is probably about £60,000 a year. It grosses about double that. So over a 10-year term, you know, the return on our initial £70,000 investment is phenomenal. And if you put that, if you benchmark that against, let's say, a property that you could invest £70,000 in, maybe a 5 or 6 bed prime student HMO, you know, the return that we get on this 25-bed block, you know, so far outstrips anything that we could possibly ever get in any other sector of the residential market, other than potentially a large development that was flipped on quickly. It really is an unbelievable investment, and it was very, very difficult to piece together. It was very, very difficult to...
What made it so difficult?
There were three parties of solicitors involved. There were our solicitors, there were Lloyds Bank's solicitors, and there was the seller's solicitors. When you're looking at 10-year leases, you've got land registry considerations. There were a huge number of sensitivities to the deal. You know, one of them being the refurb cost, which is very difficult to conclude on before we bought it, because, you know, for anyone who's refurbished a property, you'll know very well that until you start peeling back the layers, you're really just guessing. And on something of that size, some of the problems that you can potentially find can be quite significant. So coming to a degree of confidence on that before we signed the deal was an anxiety. And then because of the time that it happened, we had such a short window to find tenants that it really rendered it non-viable. You know, if we couldn't get students in, this was going to be a real slog to bridge it with professional tenants for a whole year. So this was drawing on every single arm of the business and every member of staff and every resource we had to make it work. But, you know, that property alone will net something like £5,000 a month, which, you know, itself is a small business. And when you've got the management infrastructure to do it, and continue long term, then actually it just slots into the rest of the portfolio. So it was just a huge amount of work up front. But I'm really proud of that deal that we put together, and, you know, as a team what we did. Actually,
I think I've seen some of the paraphernalia, some of the media surrounding it. It looks like a really good deal, Andy.
Yeah, thanks. We did some cool stuff, and we had some Banksy stuff in some of them. We had all these different designs, and, you know, we got all these great photos. You know, in the first year, we kept the rents a little bit lower because we really didn't have a product to sell. We were just selling it on a promise, and that was some promise, you know, because we had 4 weeks to do this. But once we did it, we got all these photos, and now every year we let it, we can, you know, we've got these great evergreen photos, and, you know, the tenants love it. The students think it's fantastic.
I'm sure they do. Great story. Andy, next up, tell us one significant mistake that you've made in the HMO property business that by sharing, you're going to help our audience potentially avoid in the future.
I mean, this is an easy one as well. And this is definitely my my most embarrassing moment.
I look forward to that.
Yeah, and the guys in the office still like to kind of rib me for it. We send out a lot of direct marketing. You know, we work with a lot of landlord databases. That's how we generate a lot of our leads for the stuff we buy, the stuff that we kind of lease. And that goes out in the form of helpful newsletters, let's say. And every month the topic might be slightly different. Well, 1 month last year, you know, or maybe the year before, and this is my responsibility, you know, the marketing is under my jurisdiction, Anyway, we sent something out and it had some information about HMO licensing, and we may have sent out some information that was inaccurate, and it wasn't intentional. It was just a lack of attention to detail. And you know, it was the first time I really realized actually, you know, how significant your reach can be to a mail shot. Even though sometimes you might not think that, because you don't hear that much, you might only get a 1 or 2%, right? But if you upset people, you know, that rate of response goes up significantly. And actually, unfortunately, we really upset some people and ended up with Trading Standards calling us because they thought we were some terrible scam artists. And,
what did you say? What was on the direct mail?
There was just some inaccuracies about what the requirements to license were, and okay. And a lot of people basically it was misinterpreted, or we misinformed them and made a lot of people suddenly think that they needed a license.
Okay.
Who then called their local council, who said, "This is rubbish. Who's told you this?" But the sheer volume that we'd sent it to, you know, was quite significant, and you know, there were, you know, definitely repercussions, and you know, got passed to Trading Standards by, you know, someone who was really upset. And look, we apologise. We really didn't intend to do that. It was a genuine mistake that I made, that I have apologised for. But by doing so, you know, we learned a huge amount from it. You know, we have a process now that all of our marketing gets sort of screened and checked, even just for proofing errors, which we didn't take it that seriously, you know, earlier on in our business life. And in the end, now we realize how important it is. And actually, you know, we recognize how, like I said, how powerful direct marketing, direct mailing can be, because the response rate to that was quite phenomenal. If we had a response rate like that from every mail shot, it would be fantastic.
Tell me though, did you, because in the world of media and PR, any PR is good PR, right? Did you make any useful connections or do a deal off the back of that, even though it wasn't exactly how you'd intended it?
We drove people to a landing page, and you know, we got a lot of email addresses and contact details off the back of that. I was very sensitive to the fact that they probably don't want following up in the short term, but we have, you know, we made a conscious decision off the back of that to slow down, to be patient, and to actually try and give value first. And that's something that John, our non-exec, taught us to do. And we've done that. And I can probably show you very quickly, because one went out yesterday, but they look a little bit like this. I don't know if viewers can see, but for those that are listening, it's a newsletter. It's a 3-4 page newsletter with some really helpful information about the state of the HMO market. And actually now, rather than get people saying, "Please take me off your list," or, you know, Trading Standards called, we get people who call and say, I've moved addresses. Can you just update my address? Because they find this information really helpful. And we really spend a lot of time and effort making it valuable for them. We tell them about what's going on in their local market. We tell them about what's going on in the wider market, what they should be thinking about, how they could be doing things slightly differently.
Great. I mean, that's a success out of a mistake, which is always a good win. You know, I think if your processes are updated now and you're providing good value and it's actually caused you to think, I think it's a really good lesson learned. So thanks for sharing that one. I'm sure HMO Nation will enjoy thinking about that. Next up, HMO portfolio plans for the next 12 months. What are you personally looking to do just in your HMO portfolio?
I'm having most of the year off HMO acquisition for myself. Busy in the business, but myself and my partner have just bought a property. We've bought a beautiful property at auction. You know, it was a cash buy, and it's going through a big refurbishment at the minute. So we are just taking a bit of time to prioritise that, to get our house how we want it. And then we're going to reset, and then we're going to look at whether or not we want to pick up another portfolio, maybe towards the last quarter of the year.
Yeah, another property.
Yeah.
Brill. Okay. And how about outside building your own portfolio? Is there anything else that you're up to in property, maybe with smart property, that you think it might be useful to share with HMO Nation right now?
You know, for me, property is a very powerful tool. And smart property, you know, is a cash generating business. You know, that's the long term plan of it. And so it isn't a business that holds equity in the form of property. Our investors do, the directors do, but that's not what smart property does. So while, you know, me and the directors, you know, we'll buy property ourselves, smart property is going to continue and we're going to keep growing that. You know, we've got some great growth plans and things are going well at the minute. Myself personally, you know, I'm working on something with Nick, one of the partners at Smart Property. We've got a site in planning at the minute. It's actually in appeal because it was rejected, although we have, you know, very strong recommendations. We're waiting back to hear on that any day. We've got a £1 option on a site for 6 new builds. So we're just looking and, you know, strategically working on those sorts of projects. And, you know, something we're looking at, you know, on the fringe of everything else is that some big HMO opportunities. We're looking at sort of 30, 40, 50 bed opportunities as well. They need a very specific type of building in a very, very specific location in the cities. And obviously there's a lot to consider with regards to scale, timeframes, sort of tenanting at the end and things like that. And that's definitely on our radar.
Big projects require big planning, but let me tell you, they are worth it. They are absolutely worth it. Okay, we're coming towards the end, Andy. Any advice you'd like to give current HMO investors?
I think there's a lot of anxiety in the HMO market now, Rupert, for a number of reasons. A lot of people are upset and frustrated by the changes in legislation. And yeah, you can be on either side of the fence on this. You can either look at it as a frustration point, and you can let that get between yourself and building a portfolio of HMOs, and you can let it sort of deter you from doing that, or you can look at it as an opportunity and sit on the other side of the fence and recognize that a lot of people feel like this, and maybe this means that yes, the market is commercializing, but if you can capitalize on that opportunity, if you can maybe infiltrate some of these sales that are happening because landlords are throwing the towel in, you know, there definitely could be an opportunity, and you need to be looking several years ahead, because portfolio landlords are not, well, generally speaking, are not likely just to throw the whole portfolio away because they've had enough. They're very intelligent people, they're very savvy, and a lot of them pay a lot of tax. And certainly, there'll be a lot of capital gains tax to pay if they do start selling this stuff. So a lot of them will be selling strategically over successive years. But if you can see that as an opportunity and you're willing to be patient and work with that, then I think, yeah, there could be some great opportunities. And especially when we look at perhaps where we are within the kind of the macro arena at the minute, where are we heading in terms of sort of our general economic position? Well, again, if you're prepared to wait and you think there might be an adjustment some point in the sort of short to medium term, then that could be an opportunity to buy as well.
Yeah, good. I like that. And how about any advice you'd like to give to people who are thinking about getting into HMO property for the very first time? What would you say to them?
I'd say keep thinking about it and try and translate some of that thoughts and intentions into actual action. It can be overwhelming what sort of HMO, where to do it, how to do it. There are a lot of people who are giving away some really great information for free. Some of it's paid for. But if you're serious about doing it, reach out to these people and maybe look for some advice and guidance. For me, looking towards people who've done it and who are doing it is key. And try and replicate their models, because there's nothing earth-shattering about this investment model. It's a particular type of house, and if you do it in a particular type of way, it will you'll be able to generate a certain amount of money, and that's fairly standard. So for those starting out, get some support and get it from the right people, because that'll really stand you in good stead.
Good, thank you. Finally, before we sign off, we'd like you to recommend one great HMO resource or business book that you'd like to share. Then if you can let HMO Nation know how they can get in touch with you, and then we'll say goodbye.
All right. You know, I've read a lot of books, Rupert, property books, investment books and things like that. And I've always found that the principles of investing really, you know, they don't change. You know, it doesn't matter whether you're investing in property, whether you're investing in blue chip stocks, whether you're investing in overseas markets, or maybe small businesses. The principles of investment, you know, should always remain with you. Protect your downside, limit your downside, look for the maximum upside. And you can, if you can apply that to property and remain unemotional about what you buy, you'll be able to buy good things. You know, make your money on the way in. Then the best book and the best book I've read about these principles is Unshakable by Tony Robbins. And it's not your classic Tony Robbins read, which is it's
a bit
quite
more motivational.
Yeah. It's very Tony Robbins, you know, for those who don't know, is a very, very successful investor. And he works very closely with some of the best investors, hedge fund investors in the country. And he's pulled a lot of their information and advice together to kind of summarize and outline, you know, the approach to investment. But you can apply that to property, and you can apply it to building a property business. And I think if you can follow and stick to that, to those sorts of principles, you're not going to go wrong at all.
Great. And what about how HMO Nation can get in touch with you if they so wish?
So I am pretty active on social media. Hook me up on Facebook or Instagram. It's Andy Graham Smart Property on Instagram. Drop me an email. It's andy@smartproperty.co.uk. Check out the Smart Property website if you want to see what we're up to and what our properties look like. That's www.smartproperty.co.uk.
Brilliant. Andy, thanks very much for sharing your journey. Let's get a quick HMO high five, and then we'll see you again soon. Thanks, buddy. Thanks for joining us. If you've enjoyed this and want more informational, educational, and inspirational HMO property content, then please hit the subscribe button and give us a like. See you next time. This content was brought to you in association with hmohub.co.uk, the UK's number one HMO platform, connecting the HMO property community.